Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Los Angeles Community Policing and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I'm coming to you from Los Angeles this evening, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. I'm excited about tonight's show because we have two special guests tonight. They're co-authors and co-conspirators, I guess, in a work called What is PTSD? And I'm sure that that is a topic that has resonance for a lot of people who deal with children who are traumatized and adults who survive trauma in their childhood but maybe aren't yet in their recovery process. We're going to talk an awful lot about this with Dr. Anna Baranowski from the Traumatological Institute in Canada, in Toronto, Canada, and with Teresa Lauer, her partner. And Teresa is a licensed psychotherapist from Washington State. And together they've written a book that we're going to talk a lot about. You know, we talk a lot about the solution here. We do talk about the problem, obviously. But we really want our community that follows us to understand that what we're after is the solution. Well, this is a very solution-oriented show. The name of their work is What is PTSD? And the Three Steps for Healing Trauma. We're going to go through all of them with our two guests in just a moment. But first of all, let me get some housekeeping out of the way. If you'd like to join us tonight, we'd love to have you. First of all, you can be in our chat room, which is open. You need to have a screen name from Blog Talk Radio, however, in order to type in the chat room. Otherwise, you can read what other people are typing, but you can't type yourself. So that is a limitation, and it takes just 60 seconds to get a screen name, so you might want to do it, especially if you expect to make future visits to any Blog Talk show, and ours always run the chat room. So that takes clicking on the sign-in or the login button at Blog Talk, creating a screen name and a password, and asking it to recognize you, and it will do that. In subsequent visits, you'll automatically be logged in, and then you can type in the chat room. Otherwise, you'll be listed as a guest, and while you're welcome as a guest, you can't talk back and forth. You can't chat in the chat room. The other way to participate is by directly calling in, and we'll give you that phone number in a while, but we're going to hold back giving out the direct phone number until we get a little bit into our show. And I do have a panel of people who's joining me now. First of all, from New Jersey, my regular cohort here and partner in crime on the show and panelist is Carol D. Levine. Carol D. Levine is the author of a book, Panic Child, The Harrowing True Story of Sexual Abuse and Assault, which is a autobiographical work. And it talks about not just her abuse, but also her recovery to some degree. Carol has been in recovery, like myself, for 30 years now, and so she has an awful lot to relate to us on the show. And thank you very much for joining us from New Jersey tonight, Carol.
Hiya, Bill. Glad to be here, as always.
All right, we have a good show, and I have a couple more panelists. There's someone from the 801 area I don't recognize that did not push the number one. So I'm just going to hold off for a moment for them. But I do have somebody from the 865 area code, and I think that's going to be Ed Ed calling in. Is that Ed?
It is, Bill. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, how are you? Ed Maschick, who calls in from regularly from central eastern Florida, around the area of Vero Beach. And Ed is a newer person to his recovery, but experienced child abuse as well in his past. So all three of us on the panel are abuse survivors tonight. And I'm sure we're going to learn an awful lot. I know PTSD is an issue for both Ed and Carol, and a little bit for me, but a little less for me. But, of course, I know an awful lot about it, having heard from so many survivors how it affects them. And we will welcome Ed and Carol's input as the show goes on, and eventually we'll open the phone lines to the general public as well. When you do call in, you have to push a number one if you intend to join the group in talking. That's how I know that someone associated with a certain phone number wishes to be a part of the discussion. All right, without further ado, I want to welcome to the air our two our dynamic duo here for tonight. First of all, and these are not in any particular order, obviously, but first of all, from Toronto, so I introduced her first. I'll bring her on the air first. Dr. Anna Baranowski, she's from Toronto, as I said, at the Traumatology Institute of Canada, I believe is what you call it, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, and thank you for the invitation to join you tonight.
We're excited because we talk about PTSD all the time, and, you know, you guys are the experts. Well, maybe we're the experts as we experience it, but you're the experts because you know what to do about it.
Well, you know, I talk about it all the time, too, and it is an area, and I love the fact that you said that you're really all about practical tools, because not only is that what I believe is the best thing for people who are trying to recover from trauma, but, you know, really with all the training that we do for professionals, that's really all we train as well. We stick to being practical because that's really what we find helps people.
Right. Well, of course, the people you'll engage on tonight's show directly are not professionals in the sense that we don't have degrees, but we are professionals in the sense that we're very passionate and engaged with dealing with people who have had trauma in their past, and so we will learn a lot from you as well, and I know you do teach it to the public as well, so we really are grateful for this opportunity to spend the 90 minutes with you.
Likewise, we're really happy to talk.
All right, and let's bring Teresa now on board. Teresa Lauer, as I said, is your partner in crime, I called her, I think.
Yeah.
she's the co-author of the book. Teresa, you're there from Washington State. How are you tonight?
Yes, I am. Yes, thank you. I'm fine. Thank you for having us as well. This is just a real pleasure to be able to talk to you tonight.
We're delighted to have you. And, of course, you're a psychotherapist.
Yes.
Who has a practice, I guess, in is it Redmond, Washington?
Yes, uh-huh, exactly, right.
And where is Redmond?
Which is just across from, Seattle, so just a stone's throw. It's just like a suburb of Seattle, so.
I see, okay.
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, we call ourselves National Association, but we're really closer to the North American Association, I guess, because we have a lot of followers from Canada, and I don't want you to feel that we don't, we have a lot of followers. In fact, I went to the University of Toronto. I may have told you this at one point and spent 3 years myself in Toronto. I love the city.
Yes, I think I do remember that. And you enjoyed it here, if I recall correctly, too.
Very much so, very much so. All right. Now, I'm going to ask the two of you, I guess, it's a little odd to have two, different for us to have two guests at the same time, and you'll notice that we can't really crosstalk here. One person kind of has to finish their thought before the other person can express, you know, the next thought. Because similar to talking on a cell phone, I guess. So we'll just do this one at a time, and either one of you can answer first, I guess. But I'm interested in what it was that brought each of you in a short way, I guess, to the issue of child abuse and child trauma, and if there was a specific reason for you to get involved with it and make it your career path or not, I'd be interested to know, and I know our public would be too.
That's such a great question, Bill. You know, I have been doing work in this area for a long time. When I started in my university days, ago, I started to get a lot of clients who were experiencing terrible childhood abuse, had experienced awful traumas as they were growing up. And what I realized, and I was still a student at the time, was that there wasn't a lot of really great training in the area of what to do with people after trauma. And I was really fascinated by it because my supervisors were, you know, giving me these referrals for clients, and they didn't have solutions either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here I was, a student, trying to figure this out, and I just read everything that I could get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt such compassion for the people that I was working with because it seemed that they were not getting the kind of care that they needed to get.
Well, you make a good point. I mean, at the root of all psychotherapy and even is that, whatever, you know, the things that happen in your youth set up how you're going to be as an adult. So it's amazing, frankly, that it took so long for this to become really to rise to the level of, you know, let's actually put a program together, some tools together that'll deal with it, because it's always been there, obviously. Ask Dr. Freud. But he didn't, you know, prescribe this. He prescribed medications to deal with it, which to us are sometimes necessary, but often are dealing with symptoms rather than the root problem. Mm-hmm. We'll find out if you agree with us, but that's sort of our consensus opinion here on the panel, I know. And then, so let me ask your cohort there, how did you get first interested in this kind of work?
Well, my actual route to doing this work is a little different, but I, like Anna, I have a great deal of compassion for trauma. I'm a trauma victim myself, or survivor, and I spent probably 35 years of my life just looking for help, and went to a number of different therapists who did not help. And so I thought there was just no answer for me myself, and finally found one that truly changed my life. He did everything correctly. He must have taken Anna's courses, because he did everything that was in the direction of helping me heal. And it truly changed my life enough so that I felt that that was, should be my life's work. And so I went back to graduate school and got my therapy degree. And then, so I've been a therapist for about 16 years now, centering on mostly rape recovery and childhood abuse victims. So I met a number of therapists, in all honesty, who didn't have the training that Anna is talking about. It's interesting that they try to, or the people that I encountered anyway, the treatment that I was getting at the time, it was for various other disorders, like how you treat a depression or anxiety, but trauma is really, truly is a different type of disorder. It's an anxiety disorder, of course, but it takes a different level of training, and that's why I'm so excited about what the work that Anna does is. It just the training is finally now starting to get out to and make trauma experts and trauma specialists, and I think that's truly needed for this.
Mm-hmm. No, that's how we feel too, and it's been something that's been a long time in coming. An awful lot of psychotherapists, you know, get training without that doesn't even include. Or is a half a day's worth of talking about child abuses, you know, and that's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. And, you know, I'm sure, as Anna said, and I'll bring her back in here, you know, so many of the clients that you would see, even if you didn't know it, you know, at least initially, underneath, you know, whatever they were experiencing symptomatically was an experience of child abuse. And I need to interject before we go on, that in our case, we think of four different kinds of trauma as being significant and being child abuse, one being sexual assault, another being violent or physical trauma, another being emotional or psychological trauma, which we think is a distinct category, and neglect, Those are the four kinds. And we talk about all four here on our show and with our nonprofit. We're interested in, you know, in dealing with all four. But isn't that true? There was very little training, really, until recently. So you kind of have to be careful about what therapist you choose, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we find a lot of people who are really not trained and, you know, I think it's up to the client, really, to have a conversation with the prospective therapist until they're satisfied that they can fulfill, you know, the needs. But anyway, we're getting out
right.
of ahead of ourselves.
Right. I agree with Bill. It is, yes.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say I agree completely. I almost feel as if my training was at the hands of my own therapist who taught me exactly
mm-hmm.
what to do and not to do. But a lot of people don't have that that luxury. And so it is important to be able to develop that trust in your therapist, of course, and know their background and know their training and make sure that they're experts. And also
sure.
That the client be able to know that they can have the power to hire also a therapist who may not be working out for them. And so that's maybe getting ahead of it a little bit as well, but that's important to know. And that's something that doesn't come intuitively because of the situation, of course, but.
No, it doesn't. Well, we always tell people that they're really interviewing their therapist, their potential therapist,
yeah.
and we recommend they see two or three before they make a choice, at least. But they
mm-hmm.
should interview that person, those people, and you know, decide who they're comfortable with. Let's instead of moving forward, let's move back a tiny bit, Teresa, just to allow you to tell us anything you want to about the kind of trauma that, you, since you said you're a survivor, that you might have experienced. If you'd like to touch on that, or if you don't, that's okay too. But we have a lot of survivors out there who will identify with a fellow survivor like yourself who's now doing psychotherapy. So if you could tell us just a little bit about it.
Yes, I actually, at 19, I was kidnapped for 14 hours and held in someone's house. At the time, and this was many, many years ago, so of course I went through the physical, you know, taking care of everything, but just completely ignored the emotional and went about my life and, you know, met my husband, developed a career. But then, you know, always with that background of there's something that's not quite right. And
mm-hmm.
and of course, avoidance is a huge part of trauma and triggers of, you know, that's just something that you become accustomed to. And again, every couple of years or so, I would feel the need to go out and seek help. Just
okay.
never finding that one person that was right for me. And for some reason, I dropped into the lap of someone that was just perfect for me. A lot of different symptoms over the years, you know, I personally, I mean, I feel like I could speak freely here, of course.
Of course.
I used food for comfort. So that was a big issue that affected my self-image, it affected my self-confidence. So, and that's really a very typical response. If we use something to kind of almost literally you can imagine stuffing down, you know, that the words, you know, you don't want to talk about it, so you're literally almost stuffing those words down. So
right.
So I'm very sensitive to how people might be coping with different traumas, you know, through drugs or alcohol. You know, we do things to help us cope with things, with emotions and feelings that are just too much. And
right.
If we can help take care of that, plus be able to, you know, find that self-soothing in ways that are more healthy, that's
mm-hmm.
definitely what we strive for. And then kind of telling that story. And that's the value, really, of a therapist or a support group or optimally maybe even both, because
mm-hmm.
you have that feeling of being with amongst people that understand in a group,
mm-hmm.
And yet mm-hmm. a therapist can then help guide you and be your, you know, take you to the next level and be somewhere where it's safe to talk. And I didn't talk about my particular situation for 8 months.
Right.
He was waiting for quite some time before the story, and that's okay.
Wow.
I saw him for 3 years, and it was the best three-year investment that I ever made. And the reason that I did that ultimately was because in going through graduate school, you have to, you know, you have to actually see a therapist. And to that point, nobody had worked for me, and finally I found one, and then
right.
went from there. But
Mm-hmm. And told your story, and that's the beginning of recovery for us.
That's the beginning, exactly.
That's what we consider the, you know, the giving up of the secret. And Anna, you know, Teresa described the overeating and the drinking and the using. There can be a lot of different reactions to childhood trauma that is unresolved, and you know, and comes into your adulthood, where decades later you're still having, you know, you're fighting with the symptoms of really your child abuse, and they can express themselves with substance abuse, overeating, undereating, you know, cutting yourself, a gambling addiction, certainly trouble with, the right relationships, hanging out with lower companions, spending money you don't have. I could go on and on and on. But a lot of people, doctor, go to their therapist at first for the symptom. And it has taken historically some time. In fact, in Teresa's case, it took months. Perhaps not in her case for this particular reason, but often the therapist doesn't ever ask or used to not ask, you know, was there any kind of trauma in your youth? And I think we're learning to do that earlier on in the sessions, aren't we now?
Oh, I think that's just such a perfect statement. You know, it is so true that so many people that I've worked with come to me after seeing another therapist. And when we really start to do some exploration, we learn that they really never did any trauma therapy. They really didn't do the exploration, the working through, the stabilization that needs to happen for somebody to have a successful experience. But I do have to actually just comment on Teresa's, what she shared.
Sure.
This is such a great example of a beautiful, graceful trauma recovery. You can hear how Teresa sounds when she's describing her story, that it comes from a place of having worked through. That's how recovery should sound, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we often don't hear that when people talk about their trauma because they haven't had the opportunity to find calm, to make sense, to work through their trauma, to restore that, and then to really connect with their lives in a very meaningful way. And, you know, we called the book Three Steps for Healing Trauma because we really recognized that we needed to cover all these three steps in order for somebody to do really thorough work in recovering from trauma, and that the finding comfort or finding calm piece of it becomes so pivotal, because until we have that peace, we can't actually properly stabilize to prepare ourselves for the deeper work of trauma working through. Like when we're doing that work where we're really being with the trauma story, we have to be able to bear witness to our own story. And how are we going to do that if we are always in a state of distress?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and we're going to talk a lot about the actual steps and the book and this training in just a minute, but I want to include our panelists and make sure that they understand that. I know they're hanging on there, and they're chomping at the bit to get at you two ladies. So let's bring them on in the order I introduced them originally, which would make Carol D. Levine from New Jersey our first panelist. As I said, Carol's been in recovery quite some time, about 30 years, like myself, and she's very passionate about child abuse awareness, and a big volunteer here. Carol, you're on the air with Anna and Teresa.
I want to welcome you both to the show. I'm so glad you're here. You know, post-traumatic stress disorder is something that a lot of people do suffer from who have been abused. And I was horribly sexually abused as a child and suffered terribly from panic. That's why my book is called Panic Child, because I was like taken over with panic. It ruled my life. and it held me back too, in a lot of different ways. And it was no easy thing. I never got help for it. I did go to a psychologist when I was in my early 30s, I guess it was, because I was sure I was crazy. I was told that I was crazy all my life. And he saw me 5 times, and he told me that I was not crazy. And I walked out of his office, and I was just walking on air. I was just so happy. It was the best high that I ever had. As a child, I drank to try and get rid of my panic disorder. I had social phobias, things like that. So what you're right on key here. You're exactly what I need to hear about, because I don't have panic today like I had it years ago. Once in a while, it'll get into me a little. I'll experience a little, but then I get mad and then it goes away. So I'm pretty much over it. I'd say 85% over, you know, and on my healing journey. But I think it's a very interesting subject, so thank you for being here.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for to telling me a little bit about the panic issue. I see that all the time. I completely understand that. And, you know, when we see this kind of panic, actually, one of the early steps that we use is we work with breath training, because what we find is that it is such an incredible stabilizer. But we work with a very specialized approach called 3-6 breathing. And actually, we use the biofeedback system. When I have my clients in my office, I can use the system. But there's actually an example of it on our whatisptsd.com website. There's a right on the front page, there's a number of different resources. And if you scroll down below the by the book, there's a section that has video links. And one of them is breath training. And the other one is a story about a trauma survivor who I interviewed on a TV show. And you can see this woman, her name is Jean, and she talks all about exactly what you're saying right now, just that incredible feeling of fear and panic and how it just makes it impossible to live your life and debilitates you and keeps you from really being able to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she mentioned panic and anger, which is another kind of triggered, we're going to talk about triggers in a minute, triggered response sometimes to PTSD. And here to talk eloquently, I'm sure, on anger, knowing him, is somebody who's not quite as far into his recovery. Ed Magic is more, you know, newer to the concept of recovery, but doing great, and he's a regular panelist with us as often as we can have him. We'd love to have him. Ed, you're on the air with Dr. Anna Baranowski and Teresa Lauer, the authors of What is PTSD? And I'm sure you want to know.
Yeah, well, hello to you both. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Edward.
Thank you. Yeah, my case is a little interesting because the events that led to me getting PTSD occurred when I was around 8 and 9 years old, but I never knew I had it until about 3 years ago. My parents knew I had it, but they never told me, and I was never treated for it. So it was just kind of allowed to fester, and in me it's manifested itself as a rage issue. You know, people talk about fight or flight. I have I have fight and flight. So it's something that's been a struggle for me to keep under control. But what I wanted to ask you was, in this country, it doesn't seem to be recognized very much. Employers don't seem to recognize it as an issue. Social Security doesn't seem to recognize it as a disability. You know, only recently with some of the news of our military, of our returning veterans with PTSD, has gotten some coverage. Do you think Canada does a better job at helping its citizens with PTSD than we do, and what can we do to try and catch up?
It sounds like you have a notion that we might be doing a better job of it. From your statement right now, Edward. I'm not sure if that's entirely true. I think, because we don't actually have psychologists in our hospital systems. And most people who do see therapists do have to pay for it out of their pocket here in Canada unless they have private insurance. They cannot get to see a psychologist in private practice. And although there are some private clinics, there are some community clinics as well, you know, you get back to the issue of what's the training and background. And, you know, as Teresa was saying, she went through quite a few therapists before she really got to somebody who really just understood what was happening and could really address the issues right directly. But, you know, I want to get back to something you just said, Edward, about your anger and how that seems to be the way it always comes out for you. And it's such an important awareness, because I find when things ignite like that, what it's really saying to me is, you know, the fight or flight or freeze. So when we feel that we're in danger, we automatically have this response. And I suspect that, you know, because this PTSD, whatever the trauma was, it sounds like it still remains unresolved for you, that whenever you have a memory, an ignition, and this can be so subtle because we don't know how powerful the unconscious mind is sometimes, that it could be just like seeing like a red car or somebody wearing a jean jacket or whatever it is that's your trigger can ignite that feeling of danger. And as you said, when you feel something, it always turns into anger. So looking at what those early warning signs of trigger are for you can probably help you pinpoint where you need to do your work. And that might be a real powerful clue to resolving some of those danger ignitions. Does that make sense to you, Edward?
Yeah, it does. I'm, you know, working more and more on trying to identify triggers. You know, I know last week I was, you know, I ride a motorcycle, and that's kind of my relaxation. Driving down the road, as I always do, listening to the songs I always do. But for whatever reason, the word family, I pulled that out of the song I was listening to, and I just, you know, I just felt my body change. I just went from a relaxed state to a, you know, tense state, and just because of that word.
Mm. And I want to avoid making a joke out of this, but Ed is a big guy, and so you don't want to get cross paths with him when he's in one of these states. Fortunately for Ed, and I will make this a joke, he only thinks of this a few hundred times a day, huh, Ed?
Yeah,
I know. Well, she seems to have you pegged there, and we're going to talk more about this to Dr. Anna Baranowski and Teresa Lauer, the co-authors of What is PTSD and the Three Things You Can Do About It. In fact, we want you to know that from this point on in our show, you should go to whatisptsd.com, that is the website for their effort, and we're going to use the website from time to time during the show to point things out. I'm sure the ladies will help me in doing that, but we're very grateful for the two of you, the co-authors of What is PTSD, one from Toronto and one from the Seattle, Washington area, joining us tonight for the hour and a half. And we remind people that it is a community participation show, so if you're in our chat room, you can type a question or a comment in there, but you have to be with a Blog Talk screen name in order to type. And then in just a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone line, so get ready with your phone with your question for the phone call, because we're going to do that too. We always include community participation, Anna and Teresa, in our show, so we'll see how that goes. But let's talk now about the program itself that you've come up with. And I guess we'll ask Anna. Were you the original person behind the concept here, or did you do this with cohorts, or how did this come about originally?
So are you talking about the three-step or the tri-phase model?
I'm sorry, the specific. I know you belong to the Traumatology Institute in Canada. I'm not sure what that means, although you have
I'm actually the executive director. I'm the CEO, and I'm the founder of the Traumatology Institute in Canada. And we have actually developed some very, very comprehensive training for therapists right now, but also we're working on a stream for people who are working in the community and trying to help it, without a therapist background. And but if you're talking specifically about that three-step model, it's actually...
Please. Let's talk about what's on the website, what is PTSD, as I told people to go there. So we'll take a look at it together.
Right. So just in terms of those three steps and why they're so very, very important, those three steps actually came from some very pivotal work by a woman named Judith Herman, who had been writing about childhood sexual abuse. Teresa will be able to talk about this as well. Right, Teresa?
Right. Uh-huh.
We actually recognize that the three steps are so important because for a lot of people, when they actually start to recognize that there's a problem, they have a very, very hard time managing all those symptoms because the symptoms can be so, so debilitating. So we recognize that in order for people just to manage their lives, finding that calm becomes a very important job. But even more importantly, if we're really going to get through to a new place in our lives and work through the trauma, we have to be able to manage facing it. So when I started to do work with trauma survivors, I could see that I was much more successful when I was working by creating stabilization, emotional stabilization to start with. My previous book was really developed to help clinicians learn about what to do with trauma survivors when they were, you know, trying to get some skill and understanding. And the first book is called Trauma Practice, Tools for Stabilization and Recovery. And we do lots of training about that as well. But that's really where a lot of the concepts in our current book, which is really for members of the public who have experienced trauma, that's where it really came from. So Trauma Practice, Tools for Stabilization and Recovery, that laid the foundation for what is PTSD, Three Steps to Healing Trauma. And of course, Teresa has been just an incredible co-author because she just brings a wealth of information and understanding about the issues to the field as well. Do you want to talk about what it was like writing this book and how that came about, Teresa?
Well, yes. Actually, I've known Anna for a while, but I just love her approach. I loved her. She has exercises that she developed that I was aware of that are just very, very powerful, but very doable. And that's hard to find, even if you go to a private therapist or that kind of thing. Many therapists don't give homework or something that you can do. Of course, that therapy hour goes very, very quickly, and so you have a number of other hours that you have to fill that, like Ed was talking about, that he had this trigger, and that word family really triggered these feelings for him. And while it may seem kind of like discombobulating, you almost feel like, oh, my gosh, this is, you know, my body changed, my whole feeling changed, what's happening to me. But actually, from a professional viewpoint, wouldn't you say, Anna, that is a tremendous step that he could even recognize, that you could recognize, Ed, that your body changed and make the connection to the word family? Because many times that's what a trigger does, is it goes so quickly from experiencing it to then reacting to it. And it's almost as if there's no filter to say, well, what's making me angry, or what's making me sad, or what's making me feel this way? That's what a trigger does. It just triggers this incredible emotion, but you, without that knowledge and that self-awareness that does come over time, that, you know, you almost feel powerless to that emotion. You know, you get angry, but you can't really figure out why. But that self-awareness that you made, Ed, is just a tremendous step from, you know, from a professional standpoint. If you were my client, I would be so happy for you right now, because it's just that connection. Wouldn't you say, Anna, that's just so powerful?
Yeah.
And those exercises that Anna introduced me to, because I had not seen those before, were just, I said, this is tremendous. We have to get this out, because therapy, professional therapy, is not for everyone, and a support group even is not for everyone. And in all, you know, being realistic, not everyone that needs it can either access it or want to or recognize that it might help. So if reading the book helps just one person, that's, I believe, the way Anna feels as well, that we will just have felt that we did our job. And but her exercises are fantastic for helping people, whether we're sitting there or not. And that's the power, I think, that I really recognize in the work that Anna does. And she just, we just really need that in the field itself.
Right. And on the website, I noticed under materials, you have the trauma response checklist and the connections exercise. These are examples of what a person might expect going through your course. Is that what I'm to survive?
Yes, absolutely. Now, but one of the things about these two little pieces is that it's kind of like the beginning and the end point, because what we want people to do is kind of do their own quick screen and have a sense of where they're struggling, you know, the areas that they're noticing are causing them the most difficulty, you know, whether it's in distress, strain, or trying to avoid the memory, or noticing that they're having intrusive feelings or thoughts. Those are kinds of things that we want people to start becoming aware of. And then in that checklist, there's actually a little screen scoring on that on the download. But then the other one is really all about connections. And the connections exercise is something that we encourage people to do at the very end of the book, when they've gotten to a place where they're feeling like they really can reconnect in a meaningful way in things in their community, make connections, because we know that, you know, having people in our lives, meaningful relationships, is such an incredible buffer, helps us really feel supported and recover. And when we've got a good skill, or we've found a network or community that can support us well, you know, it can really help us in our road to feeling better overall.
That's one of the things that we're trying to do here, of course, is to create the sense of community, everybody having to play their role in putting a dent in the statistics of child abuse, because they're horrendous. Mm. And also, of course, too, and we agree with you, there isn't any one path that we proselytize about as far as recovery. We recognize that there can be many paths to that you could call the journey of healing, or whatever you want to call it. And we list them all because we want people to be aware of the fact that we, you know, while we're not promoting one over another, we are promoting the concept of recovery. We think everybody can, you know, can benefit from taking sometimes a hard look at themselves, you know, but an honest look at themselves, and especially if they can be guided with either an individual or a group, you know, in a place that they can feel safe and trust the group, because they're there for the same reason, for example, or the therapist is well, you know, well briefed on what to on how to help them, that there can be great benefit to sharing your secret. And for a lot of abuse survivors, it is a secret that they've held in onto sometimes for decades, and it's affecting really every part of their life. So now you ladies also know that you become a member of our family, so that's how we extend our community. Every time we can suck somebody into being a special guest, no, I'm not kidding, to invite someone on to be a special guest, we make you an honorary member of our family, and we include you. And that means that we want you to feel a part of what we're doing at NASCA and on the show, and you can participate in any way you like in the future, obviously, too. But let's get some comments then from our two panelists, and let's allow them some time with you. First of all, back to New Jersey, to Carol Levine. Carol, questions or comments for Anna and Teresa about what you've heard so far?
Well, I think probably with the breathing exercise, that's probably very good, because when I used to go into meltdown, because that's what it was meltdown, with the social phobia, of course, I felt like I was going to die because I was breathing so fast and so quickly. As a child, I was so horribly humiliated by my family, even before I was sexually abused, and saw too much domestic violence. And, you know, there's a lot of humiliation involved before I even was with the sexual abuse. I had that put upon me as well. By the time I was 9 years old, I was having panic attacks. And I couldn't go in front of my peers. I felt dirty and ugly and stupid and all kinds of things. So I would go into panic mode. And during those days, excuse me, there was no help. There was no help. And so that just made me feel crazy. You know, it made me feel like there was something very wrong with me. Not taking into consideration as a child, well, look, you're this way because of. So all the things you have listed here, and the very fact that you work with post-traumatic stress disorder and panic only being one of the many things that people can suffer from, is a very, very good thing. And on my healing journey, which didn't happen until I was in my 20s, late 20s, through a church, through a prayer group, they saw something in me. And they made me go out and work with kids who were delinquent, because I had been delinquent, kids who were into drugs. And as I worked from one to another, that's how I started to heal. And I started to get self-esteem back. And that was one of my major problems. I had no, it was so, my self-esteem was so low.
Yeah. And that's something a lot of trauma survivors will identify with. That, you know, we feel like, well, we feel at fault, a lot of us. We feel guilty, we feel ashamed, we feel embarrassed, we feel less than. We want to hide out that part of our story anyway, of our, how we grew up. And we're afraid that we'll get thrown away, frankly. I literally was afraid I'd get thrown out of the group that I first went to for help, where I went for help really from alcohol problems that I thought I was having. And sure enough, I heard your signature secrets and started sharing about child abuse, and I was terrified they were going to kick me out because it wasn't for that kind of group, you know. It wasn't that kind of group. But they fortunately said, no, you keep coming back. We don't understand this issue, but we also don't know who else might be coming into this group who has that issue and needs to hear what you're saying. They gave me permission to simultaneously recover from drugs and alcohol and begin my journey of recovery from my child abuse. It was really miraculous that that happened that way. Because as Carol said, there was no help back then. This was in the early 80s. And now there's a bit of a more consciousness and a bit of a more help, but nowhere near the amount that's needed for the amount of people that are suffering. Anna, Teresa, any comments as to what Carol just said?
You know, there are a number of different things that are really important. First, I want to talk about something called the silencing response. You know, it's interesting how all of this shame and self-blame and loss of self-esteem, you know, so much of that could only have occurred in the context of silencing. So everybody loses their voice. They think that they are wrong. They have nobody to turn to. Their story is invalidated. There are all sorts of reasons why they don't want to speak the story. There isn't a platform that is safe. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea of the contents must be silenced in order for this to really have taken hold, because perpetrators must instill silencing. And then there's a community of silencing. People don't want to hear this story. They don't want to know. They're trying to protect others. This is such a common theme. And I can see how it just pulls apart the human fabric and leaves an individual feeling completely without worth. So no wonder there's no voice and there's panic, because, you know, it really requires the individual to kind of almost even further betray themselves, because there's nobody to turn to, you know, no reasonable outlet. So you turn to drugs, or you turn to alcohol, or you find outlets that, you know, can at least take away the pain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I still experience some of that even today, all these years later, and working on the issue. Because it seems like the issue is falling on deaf ears. This is my problem. And I know how hard, other volunteers that work with me work on this issue. And we do it unpaid. In fact, we're not even supported. We do it out of our own pocket. So, there's no remuneration coming back in terms of a salary or anything. We're not earning, and we're not looking for that right now. But, I mean, there's very little feedback other than people like yourself, obviously, who come on, and we know that we're ringing the right bell when you validate what we're saying. But I have to the point is that even today, after all these years of working on myself, I can still slip into the kind of the poor me's a little bit. You know, why am I doing this? You know, what's the meaning of this? Is it having any effect? Why am I wasting, quote unquote, my life doing this? Of course, I get out of it pretty fast, but it comes up. Is the point. And you have to guard against it, and you have to be ready to recognize what it is. It's a temporary feeling today. It's not my permanent feeling, and there's things I can do to overcome it, like express it tonight, for example.
Uh-huh. Right, yeah. Right.
Now, did you have another thing you wanted to say? You said there were a couple things. If not, we'll go on to Ed and let him chime in here.
I think Teresa wanted to say something. Teresa, what was on your mind?
Oh, well, the one thing I wanted to mention, like you were saying, Anna and Bill, the silencing effect of it, the response, is when we experience something really traumatic, our first impulse really is to share it with people. Like when there's, let's say, for example, Anna and I were talking about this a while back, but it's kind of that earthquake response. Everybody talks about it. Where were you? What did you feel? What went on for you? And that almost works as a release valve so that you, you know, it takes some of the intensity of a shared experience away. And so you feel like you're not alone. And that's why we tend to share these tremendous traumatic things that happen, like an earthquake or something that a lot of people share at once. But that just doesn't exist with child abuse or sexual abuse. You're really stopping it before it even can get out to somebody else, because who wants to talk about that, really? And who wants to hear it? And who wants to, you know, sit with somebody else's pain? And that's really sometimes a therapist or a support group is the first time that a survivor of something such as this has had someone sitting with their pain. And that takes a lot of the pressure off, and you almost feel like you were explaining a while back, is you just like a pressure release, you know, and you almost feel like, okay, somebody understands, I'm not alone. And that's why shows such as yours are so very important to that one person who may have no one to express it to, so that if that pressure just builds and builds and builds until you're I think people get very practiced at saying, I'm going to keep the lid on because I have to protect myself, and I have to protect, like Anna was saying, the people around me. There's all sorts of reasons why we don't share something as personal and intimate as this. And it really is an intimate subject.
Right, and it's a taboo subject as far as the community is concerned. And there are lots of us who will tell you that as part of our childhood abuse story, when we tried to relate it to an adult, we ended up telling an inappropriate adult, someone who, in my case, took advantage of me himself. And that was an extra, you know, an extra pain that I bore, you know, for years and still bear to some degree. You know, because I've told my story a whole bunch of times in inappropriate ways too. That's the other thing I want to touch on. I was molested by many men, all men, priests and brothers and lay people, and I did not feel homosexual. I wasn't interested in men at all. So in my 20s, when I finally got away from that environment, I told girls all the time, and I got sex for it. I used it as a weapon, in other words. But that's inappropriately telling the story. I don't mark my recovery, and I even told a psychiatrist my story and a couple of parish priests. I got no recovery out or any kind of help from any of those people until I started on the journey that I described earlier in the last segment. But so you can also tell your story, and it can fall on deaf ears, and that's an additional big wound for a child.
Right, exactly.
So that their trust might be broken. All right, let's bring Ed on and get him involved. Ed, you're back on the air with Anna and Teresa, and you must have a comment or a question or five by now.
Well, yeah, where to start?
I know.
I told the wrong person, too. You know, I told my mother, and her response was, don't tell anyone else because they'll make fun of you for it. So not only did she not save me, she forced me to continue to interact with the people who were responsible for my assault. And, you know, you know, as Bill said, we're real active in this. Most of us are. And I had occasion to go to a conference here a few months ago and talk to a woman who's a deals with a trauma unit in Pennsylvania. And she was the first one who ever kind of looked at the whole situation and made the... Because I've got sarcoidosis, I've got hypothyroidism, hypogonadism, eczema and psoriasis, all these autoimmune problems.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first one to draw the link or say, you know, the one thing that all those do have in common is that they are autoimmune related. And, I mean, have you guys come across a link like that in your research and your practice where, I mean, there are studies that show that people who were abused do have other real-world health problems, other physical mm-hmm. health problems.
Edward, you know, you're raising an important issue. In the, I think it was in the 50s, Hans Selye, he was a researcher. He did a lot of very interesting work, first with animals. But what he understood was there was an issue with what he called diseases of adaptation. So what he did was he exposed animals, and this was animal research. He exposed animals to stressful stimuli over a long period of time. You know, you might put them in a cage where, you know, water was filling up or do something that would actually create stress for the animal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what he found was that those animals were much more inclined to develop all sorts of diseases of adaptation, heart disease, gastrointestinal problems, things like that. So, you know, absolutely, there's something going on here. And we can't change. We cannot separate our bodies from our minds, from our emotions, from our behaviors, from our world. So absolutely something is going on physically when we have experiences that are emotionally devastating. It can't be separated. Just
mm-hmm.
possible. I don't know mm-hmm. how things have worked for you specifically, but the research is there with Hans Selye's work in terms of diseases of adaptation, and this goes back quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see over and over again a correlation between child abuse and other things that occur, and it's not hard to believe. We saw a recent study where heart disease was linked to it, especially and other stress-related kind of illnesses. You know, keep adding to the list of things that, you know, could have their beginning in early childhood trauma. After all, your brain starts to develop differently when you're traumatized from the normal kid's brain, the normal child's brain, and that continues to happen until you're 25, and that's when your brain is more or less fully developed. The good news being that there's so much unused portion of our brain that there is additional capacity to continue to, if we work on it, though, it doesn't automatically happen, to develop, there's so much gray matter left over, even after our brain is so-called, quote, fully developed at 25, to redevelop and retrain it in our adulthood is possible, and that's one of the things, you know, again, they're starting to do big studies. The ACE study was part of that, and an article we have on our recommended article section called The Bomb in the Brain talks about this and so forth. But before I get too far astray, I do want to, as I promised, open the phone lines up to the general public. And Anna and Teresa, we don't know what kind of calls we might get here. We might not get any, but that's okay. We have enough people to finish the show easily. Enough questions for you.
Yeah.
But let me announce that the phone lines will be open now at 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. Our special guests this evening are Dr. Anna Baranowski from Toronto's Traumatology Institute. She's the CEO and the founder of that institute. And her co-author, Teresa Lauer from Redmond, Washington, which is right across from Seattle. On their book, their new book is called What is PTSD? The Three Steps for Healing Trauma. And we're going to hear about those three. We're going to ask them about the three steps, or I am. I know what they are. Finding calm, remembering your trauma, and beginning to live again. Did I get that right?
Beautiful.
Okay. And we're going to talk about, those are the three basic parts of it. But, of course, there's a lot of work to be done. But if you're like me or our panelists here tonight, or Teresa herself, and has experienced childhood trauma, you'll recognize a lot of the symptoms, as will Dr. Anna Baranowski, as being a therapist for many years, very similar. I mean, we have very similar experiences, not experiences, but reactions to the experience, despite no matter what kind of trauma we had, whether it was sexual, physical, emotional, or through neglect. If we grow up into our adulthood with that as a secret, and we try to hide that secret from others and from ourselves sometimes, it can jump out at us as symptomatic, triggered responses in PTSD. Trigger meaning, of course, something that causes a reaction. A trigger is something that causes a reaction. And it can be a physical thing, or it can be a memory or a smell even, or a sound. So please do join us, 646-595-2118. For Dr. Anna Baranowski and Teresa Lauer. And remember to push the number 1 if you want to join the conversation. You get instructions to do that. So I described the three essential steps I gave away as finding calm, remembering your trauma, and beginning to live again, Anna. Do you mind if I gave them away?
I love that.
We're going to ask you and Teresa to comment on the three of them as we still have a half an hour left in the show. And, of course, as we noted at the very top of the show, our organization, while we do study the problem and we talk about the statistics of the problem and we talk about some of the criminal aspects and stories and the changes in the law that we think, ultimately we're here to promote the concept of recovery. And we believe that's available to at least the large majority of people who have untreated child abuse going on in them right now, sometimes decades old. So I'm going to ask Anna and Teresa to talk about, well, we talked a little bit about finding calm, but what an additional would you elucidate about finding calm as being the first step to healing PTSD?
So the first thing that happens when a client walks in to my office, I don't know about you, Teresa, is they tell me all the reasons that they're not doing well. And
right.
I am always paying attention to what's happening to people physiologically, you know, their heart rate and their breathing and how their body feels. And they always tell me that their body feels terrible. And
right.
If I don't address that, if I don't start right there, then
mm-hmm.
every other step, I just cannot get access. I can't get a grip. I can't get the movement that I'm looking for. And I'm so keen to see them get to a place where they are doing well, that
mm-hmm.
this is where I really always start. What about you, Teresa?
Well, and in keeping with that, one of the things that I found also was the in delving a little deeper into how they're doing at one particular time or another, the one thing that seems to often be a problem for people is touch. And without touch, of course, you know, with our intimate partners and with just regularly throughout the day, it's hard to calm yourself. You can't, if you feel pulling back from people, which is a natural reaction, of course, with sexual abuse or especially childhood abuse, that pulling back of and not letting people touch you. Physically, this is one of the things that I have been difficult for a lot of the clients that I have. And then once we start talking about that and having that as a means of also comforting yourself, you know, to know that all touch is not bad touch. You can hug someone and they can hug you back, and you can hold hands, and you can have that intimate contact without being in danger. And so that's one place that I found a lot of work is very, very helpful and kind of gets that movement that Anna was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard for people to feel comfort. Yet, you can't really get that intimacy with another person without things like hugging. And so, I, like Anna, I do believe that the body, I mean, you know, that physical, you know, state of your body is just so important. And then, of course, allowing yourself to feel comfortable within your body, which is a whole other thing of, you know, sort of being disconnected, especially when you go into what you're going to talk about next with remembering the trauma. A lot of times we experience disconnection from the body, and that's a whole, you know, a grounding, you know, being kind of one with your body. It definitely starts there, yeah.
Well, I can remember in my early recovery that I practiced things like, well, biofeedback breathing, you know, you mentioned. I was doing it and not really knowing what I was doing, but I would lay on the floor, prone on the floor, with my sort of legs and arms resting calmly out to the side, and I would practice breathing and just try to pay attention only to the breathing. Breathing in the solution is the way I would think of it, and breathing out the problem. And that's and I was able to calm my heart rate down. It was amazing. Then I tried some meditation. That also had big benefits. And I'm sure, although I didn't go this route, I just didn't have it available to me, that I would have benefited from perhaps some massage or that kind of thing, as you're talking about the touch therapy. I'm sure that would have been, it does today, so I know it would have been too, you know, been something I actually crave, you know. And maybe it was at the root of why I was so susceptible as a child to the, you know, to the sick admiration of the people that molested me. But I was craving attention and affection, even then. So that's I understand that from my own experience. And let's see what I'm going to do. This I'm going to open Carol and Ed's mics both, and I know they'll behave. Now we got a lot of people that have to behave here. and also I have someone who's on the 801 area code who never pushed the number 1, and they've been there the whole show. If they want to join the conversation, they need to push the number 1, and I will watch for that, and I'll let you people know if they do want to join us. But anyway, they're listening on their phone line. So Carol and Ed, you're on the air with us now, and why don't you guys make a comment about that first aspect of it, finding calm. Calm.
Yeah, I can say something about that for sure. Number one, I'm on all kinds of, well, not all, I'm on two kinds of medications, one for the heart, because I have MVP and I forget what the other one's called, but it has to do with the blood flow. My blood flow is backwards, okay? Aortic regurgitation, it just came to me. And then also, too, I take something for my stomach because I have acid reflux very badly. And I notice I have it when I'm nervous. So I do take something for that. So I understand the body thing that you're speaking about. How do you feel? What is your body telling you? It's just like with people who suffer from aches and pains all over their body. It's because, you know, they have been abused and their body is screaming out. And so that I understand with. And then understanding, too, about the touch. Mm-hmm. If I'm in control of the touch, I'm a very mushy person at this time in my life, and I wasn't always like that, okay, it took me a long time to get there. I love to hug, and I love to be hugged when I'm in control. But if someone just all of a sudden puts their arm around me and I'm not expecting it, I immediately stiffen. Mm-hmm. Whoa. Like, maybe in my mind, the back of my mind, I wonder, what are they going to do next? Who knows? I mean, it's not a conscious thing that I'm doing. It's just I stiffen. That happened just the other day. So, yeah, I understand those two things very well. I can identify with them.
I'm going to add one other thing to finding calm, which was something that they told us in the alcohol program that I went to. They said, don't let yourself get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. HALT, H-A-L-T is the acronym for that. And it's really true. I discovered that, and it didn't take me long to figure this out, that if I handled three of those things, I could stay reasonably calm. But if two of them were out of order, I was like nuts, you know. So I really have to, and two of them I can do by myself, and two I need others for. The first two, you know, hungry, first one, hungry, and tired, nobody can sleep for me, nobody can eat for me. So I have to eat enough, you know, not overeat, but eat enough, and sleep enough, you know. And then the other two in the middle, I need other people for, angry and lonely. And that also has to do, you know, to me, with the psychology of being calm, which it'll have to do with the other two steps that we're coming up with, too. But I just thought of that. I hadn't thought of it in years. Something that, you know, relates to finding calm for me, certainly. It still does today.
And look at how interesting it is that you naturally found ways to find calm, that we're all actually wired this way, Bill, that we all have the innate ability to find calm. And just the knowledge that, look, you just have to take the time and find a way to find that inner core, that place where calm can be found, and know that it's there. Like, you were very courageous in those moments where you let yourself just kind of lie back and used your breath in this very intuitive way. But the reality is we're all wired that way. We are all wired to find calm, and knowing that is a very powerful thing, because it gives us our power back and helps us to recognize that we just need to find it. We need to find the instrument that will work for us. So, you know, when we talk about breathing, that's just one little piece. There are a lot of different ways to get to the same goal. And although, you know, I love the book that we wrote, I think it's got lots and lots of tools, the reality is everybody has their own road to finding calm. The idea is you just have to find it.
And I've worked with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people myself over the years, hundreds. And when they finally make a phone call to me and they go, I don't know what's wrong, but I don't feel anything. I go, that's what we've been praying for all this time. You pray for serenity. You pray for serenity, right? God grant me this serenity to blah, blah, blah. And when you finally feel it, you don't know what the heck it is. It's so new. You know?
Right, and that is just perfect, because what it does is it just really reinforces the ideas. When you've had a trauma history, when you've had a very complex history, boredom is great. So being able to find a place in your life where you've got enough space that it's not going to be about drama, it's going to be about thriving. And that opens up a whole different door in life. And that's, you know, that's where we start to head when people really get to that place where they are seeing recovery. Life starts to look really different. Possibilities start to look different.
I'll go along with that, too. But one thing I want to ask you about, see, my panic was situational, okay? If people left me alone, if I wasn't, like, put in front of the class, say, to read an essay or something, I was fine, okay, in a situation, say, like in school, because that's where my biggest panic was. Not that I didn't suffer panic in other ways. I didn't like stores either. I was almost to the point of agoraphobia, almost. But I did get myself out of that because I like to shop too much. I mean that.
There you go. Yeah, shopping therapy can help.
okay. So I was not going to let that stop me from going to the stores. No. And but on the other hand, I did have panic, you know, in the store at times. But I could, you know, get myself out of that. However, because I've been so humiliated all my life as a child and even into early adulthood, I suffered terribly in certain situations. That's why I say it was situational. Now, when you're standing up in front of a crowd, I don't have this anymore, by the way. I did get over it. Thank God. But when you're standing, say, like in front of a group of people and you go into panic mode as a child, I don't know how a child could get themselves out of that panic mode, because that's situational.
Well, there are all these things are situational, though. I mean, we're talking about PTSD.
Yeah,
and they're all situational. My panic would have come if I'd not been paid attention to in school. I was the kid that always raised his hand with the controversial point, you know, or question. I always wanted to keep the conversation going, and I wanted to get called on and go up to the front of the room. I would panic if it didn't happen, you know. So it was a different response to the same kind of, you know, things going on with us. But it's still panic. I hated the fact that I was inconsequential, and I felt like I would be, and perhaps that's what I'm relating to, you know, having re-experienced today, that I will be inconsequential, you know, somehow. So that's part of my panic. Does that make sense to you, Anna or Teresa?
Well, it's just, you know what, I think it's a beautiful example of how in humility we find courage, because just the fact that you're able to say these things out loud, Bill, I have a feeling that this was hard earned, that it didn't just come automatically. You weren't able to simply say right from the beginning all of your worst fears to an audience, a radio show. And here you are expressing these kinds of things, and it just sounds like you have earned the position you're in right now with all the self-awareness that comes with it. And that's a really beautiful thing, because it does change everything for you. It changes your ability to find your own understanding and contentment and peace. So it's a really nice thing.
Well, and this is a result of a lot of work, and I thank you very much for your compliment. I don't want to take it lightly. I really do appreciate the kind words, but I worked really hard to be who I am today. And the next section of what we're going to talk about, remembering your trauma, I have been talking about for literally 30 years, in front of people, in front of small groups and large groups, in front of individuals, and even at conventions. It was only in the last few years that, once my parents both passed away, I had made myself the promise I would not go public with my story until their demise, and once that happened, I have been going public with it. But I've been saying it for a long time, and this is, you know, you're right. It's taken a lot of work to get here, but I absolutely have no problem reading any page from any chapter of any part of my life to anyone who needs to hear it when it seems appropriate, and that's who I want to be for anybody who needs it. So. So that has to do with remembering your trauma and really honestly facing it, you know, and sharing it and listening to other people who have had similar traumas or have worked through similar experiences, at least, and, you know, sometimes taking their suggestions, let's put it that way, you know, and really it's work. It doesn't just it doesn't drop on you, you know, it doesn't just manifest. You have to work at it, but there can be a lot of success and recovery when that happens. So, but remembering your trauma is the next of the steps. And, you know, that we have about 10 or 12 different ways of recovery on our, but they all include this one thing in common. Either for an individual, which could be a therapist or a minister, or a psychologist, whatever, or a coach, a life coach, as they call them some days, or a group, you know, that can be an adult survivor group or a 12-step program perhaps, or some other kind of group or group therapy that's guided. The sharing of the story in a trusted situation, in a trusted environment where you feel safe. And for the first time, that's the beginning of recovery, but you need to keep doing it. I mean, that you might get some kind of relief from telling it at one time, but it's the repeated telling of it. And the more and more you tell it, the easier it gets to share the burden, I guess, to alleviate the burden and the secret itself. But it also gives you opportunities to recognize what you're saying, because at first you don't even know that. So talk a little bit about remembering your trauma.
Well, I'm actually going to take you back a step first.
Sure.
First, before we get to remembering trauma, what I do with clients and what I encourage people who are reading the book is to be able to test finding calm with a lower level memory, not the worst one you've ever had. Because what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to see that, in fact, even when, you know, you have a momentary upset, you know, a blip on the radar screen, something happens, something's upsetting to you, that you can, again, find calm.
Uh-huh.
And that once you're able to test that and do it and use it and use the skills and get yourself back to a stable place, then you're ready to take that next step. Go into that remembering trauma and starting to work through, because what we see, and, you know, for some people, I mean, I do a lot of work with veterans, and some of the veterans are, you know, people who were in earlier wars. And, you know, it's been 15 or 20 or 30 years since that point of trauma, exposure, and they've never gotten any help. And they come to this very concerned about really falling apart. So we spend, potentially we'll spend quite a bit of time on the finding calm state before we actually get to this remembering work. And, you know, when they can really show that they are stable and they can get themselves to finding calm, we start touching on those memories, they can be quite explosive because they've been holding it like a pressure cooker for all these years.
Oh, yeah.
Can you remember what that might be like for somebody to hold on to something so, so dearly? Because they're really frightened, and it can be very devastating to carry that, right? So
Absolutely. We
work with all sorts of different exercises. There's a ton of stuff in the book that that people can use to guide themselves through that working through process. You know, and we also recognize that, you know, working with a book can be a perfect solution for one person, and for another person, when they get to that remembering trauma piece, they'll start to work through it, and they'll have to really ask themselves, should I have a guide? Do I need a therapist? And we really encourage people, if they feel that they're ready to take that step with a therapist, to really take their time and find somebody that feels good, feels right to them, somebody that they don't have to prove anything to.
And by the way, we should have mentioned earlier than this that you do this training not only in person, but also via Skype and over the internet and so forth too. So I wanted to make sure we got that included. Teresa, were you going to say something?
Oh no, I'm fine. I'm just following along.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that, Bill. We actually train therapists to do this kind of work, and of course we actually have our compassion fatigue training coming up in October for therapists who themselves have become overwhelmed. And you know, that's an interesting issue, because a lot of the care providers that we find experience compassion fatigue, and compassion fatigue is really secondary traumatic stress and burnout. It's when you've been exposed to somebody else's trauma. And we find that a lot of the therapists or caregivers who experience compassion fatigue have primary trauma of their own.
And maybe so, that's some of what I have.
Sorry?
That might be some of what's going on with me.
Oh, are you feeling compassion fatigued in your helping work?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I just, as I related before, I know in myself that there are times when I can get down on what I'm doing. And, you know, at the top level of my consciousness, I understand that this is really important work. And even if I affect one person in my life doing all this work, and I've affected, I'm sure, hundreds,
right.
You know, we get phone calls. In fact, this is 10 or 12 of us on our website. We do all this for free. So
yeah.
it adds up the responsibility, I guess, factor. Plus, you want to see, you know, we're naturally, you want to see a result. And it's not an easy thing to measure how effective we're being. We know we're being followed. We know that you and you two ladies, you know, your show, which is being recorded now, will be listened to 30 times as many people as will listen to it live, at least. And over time, you know, it'll stay as a part of one of our recommended, you know, library of shows. And many people will benefit from hearing this show in the months and even years to come, and we'll never know it. But it means a lot to us that you're engaged with us tonight. And I want to warn you that we only have 6 minutes left. That's how fast these shows go.
Right.
So I do want to touch on at least the last of the three. We didn't really do justice to the second one. Remembering your trauma, and we won't be able to do justice to beginning to live your life again. But that's the third plank, the third step in healing trauma in your program, which you can find, by the way, if you're listening to us, at whatisptsd.com. And that's, of course, part of the show description, which will always follow with the show, too, so people will be able to find that site. But let's talk just a tiny bit, if we could, briefly about beginning to live again as the third step in healing trauma in your program.
Teresa, do you want to take this one, since I had chatted about working through trauma?
Yes, I just also wanted to say really quickly, Bill, before I do, you know, it just means so very much to me as, you know, both a professional doing this and as somebody who's had the experience that someone such as yourself is reaching out to people, because what you said is absolutely true, is that you don't know who you're going to affect or who's listening right now that you could be affecting their life in such a positive way, and the fact that you reach out, you know, like you said, for 30 years you've told the story and you've, you know, you've put yourself on the line is just, it's magnificent work. And, you know, what we do is one part of it, but what you do is just such an important part, and I just wanted to say that. And the last part of it, it has to do with beginning to kind of reintegrate into.
Oop, did we lose her?
Yeah.
Reintegrate into. We heard reintegrate in. I think she's going to say into, Anna.
No, the story.
Yeah.
Really, it's all about being able to reintegrate ourselves into a meaningful life.
Back.
Oh, great. Teresa, you're back.
There you are. There you are. Okay.
Oh, you didn't hear all that?
No, we just heard up to reintegrate into life, and I was.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, my phone must have cut out for a while. Well, if I could just say one more time, then I'm
please,
sorry. What I was saying
do.
Was. Oh, thank you, Bill. What I was saying was the work that you're doing is so important. I just wanted to say that before I jumped into the last part, because really you're living what that last part is the social part, the sharing of your own experience, the reintegrating into life again and beginning to live again and to feel life. And I was just what I was saying, and I'm sorry you missed it, is that the work you do is so important. I know you were saying you've been doing this for 30 years and you don't know, you know, sometimes it gets, you know, you can get tired, and you can have exactly what Anna was talking about, is that compassion fatigue, and you tend to wonder, well, what good am I doing? This is such a huge problem, but I'm sure you've touched so many lives, and just the work you're doing is so fantastic, and I just wanted to tell you that, you know, I
appreciate that. And I'll tell you what we're going to do for those people who are listening live. The show will end in a couple of minutes, but I want to allow you both ladies to give us a comment on this third plank, because I think it's so important, and it will become part of the recorded show, even though a lot of live people won't be able to hear some of the comments. So, Teresa, take your time, but go ahead and start, if you would, start that sense that you were going down the path that included the reintegration into, and then you were cut off. So.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, that was a while ago. I'm sorry. Well, we look first at the physical connections and getting involved with life again. And really that means doing activities that you really love to do, or maybe that you've always wanted to do but that you never had an opportunity to. Things like bowling, gardening. I mean, it seems to be simplistic, but these are all things that start putting you in touch with your body again. Doing physical activities, walking, that type of thing. The second is intellectual and reconnecting with your intellectual pursuits, because sometimes, as Carol was saying before, if she almost felt as if she could have, if not for the shopping therapy, she could have had agoraphobia. And that, right. And all of these exercises are really designed to help you, you know, not let that happen, to engage in life again. The third, spiritual and personal growth exercises. Reaching out, I'm sorry, I skipped right over our other one. Creative and artistic pursuits is another one that we really touch on. Getting in touch with your creative side, basically. Mm-hmm. Spiritual and personal growth, that's very, very important. Maybe looking into, it doesn't have to be one particular religion or another, but just a mindfulness, and it all wraps up into, you know, beginning to live your life again. And I think it goes back to something that you had touched upon, Anna, before, is it's finding that some self-compassion, number one, that's very, very hard for people to do. And one thing that I suggest, because a lot of my clients have experienced sexual assault, is how would you, and this is a little tiny exercise that's very helpful, is when you get down on yourself, you know, when you start blaming yourself for what has happened, because you truly are not your experience. Experience is what happened to you. Is how would you feel if your best friend or your mother or your son or your father, someone you truly love and have a lot of compassion for, if they heard your story, what would you say to them? And many times we tend to berate ourselves for the experiences that we've had and not being good enough, but of course we wouldn't dream of telling somebody that we love, you know, get over it, what are you doing? You know, it goes back to the point that you were making of telling the wrong people sometimes, sharing our story with the wrong people. And so that's finding that self-compassion has a lot to do with that third, we do mention it in the first part, but it also has a lot to do with the third part, because it's knowing what we need in life. Mm-hmm. Do we need physical connection again? Do we need intellectual pursuits? Do we need to reintegrate? What do we need to begin living again?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anna, would you like to add anything to that final thought?
Just that I just love the fact that Teresa was on this call and that I really, really appreciate the work that you are doing. And I do agree with Teresa wholeheartedly that I think that, you know, this work that you're doing has incredible value, because, you know, there is nothing more important than knowing that somebody else is speaking up about these things,
yes,
has dealt with them themselves. And I think that that in itself is incredibly therapeutic, because it's one thing hearing a therapist say, oh, yeah, you know, you can get over this stuff, and a completely different thing hearing it from somebody who's walked the walk and really knows what it really takes to get through
this
kind of thing.
And this is the sense of what we're trying to do here at NASCA, at the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. We want those people who are in recovery and our friends, obviously, who understand the issue to speak out and not only raise awareness but cause, you know, people to take action, because we think everybody should be involved with, every adult certainly should be involved with every child in our country, in our nation, in our North America, and you know, has a responsibility towards all the children. And at the same time, we're a little bit unique because we do reach out to adult survivors. And we want them to know that there's a lot of hope for you. There are lots of paths to recovery. We offer a discussion about 10 or 12 different kinds without proselytizing about which one is appropriate. You need to decide what's appropriate for you. But we can tell you is that we come from a variety of different backgrounds, and that, you know, we are grateful. Some of us, it took 40 years before we even started down the road of our recovery. I work with a man who's 71 years old now. For the last year, he's worked with me. For 35 years before that, he'd been sober, and nobody had ever taken him to his child abuse issues. And the man is on different footing today, and he shared with me that in 1 year, you know, he's gone miles beyond where it took him 35 years to get prior to that. This is what can happen. And
right.
That we just want, Anna and Teresa, for one child to avoid what happened to us, or one family to avoid what happened to our families, and that's why we do this work. So, Carol, you want to just give us a 10-second final thought, and then Eddie's going to follow up?
Okay, well, I just want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I'm the one that's very much the optimist on this show. And, Bill, I hope tonight what these ladies said will instill in you, you'll see for yourself after what they said just how important this show is and how important you are.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. She's a regular participant and panelist on the show, and I couldn't do it without her. I don't want this to be a monologue. It needs to be at least a discussion, a dialogue, and hopefully a discussion, which means three voices or more for me. Ed, you're often that third voice, and we love having you. A final thought from you?
Just, you know, very, very informative show. Very glad to be here. I think we could have a week's worth of shows with these two wonderful ladies and not learn everything we need to from them. So I hope they come back.
Well, I totally agree. And Anna and Teresa, as I told you before, you become a member of our family by appearing on our show, and we'll always have this show and the recorded version available on demand as part of one of our recommended shows. But we also want to encourage you to come back in any way, shape, or form you wish. If you want to comment on our website and you think there's something missing or something that needs to be included or a broken link, let me know. And if you ever want to come back on the show, either just show up and be a panelist, or we will, of course, in the future, we'd be sure to follow up with you somewhere down the road with another show that features you both, Dr. Anna Baranowski and Teresa Lauer from Toronto and the Seattle, Washington area, respectively. Thank you, ladies, both very much for being
here. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you.
All right. And we extended the show just a little bit longer than normal, but that will become part of the recorded available show, the on-demand version of the show. And so we are delighted to have had our special guest tonight and look forward to some additional special guests as the weeks and months go on. We're on the air 6 nights a week, every night except Saturday night. And we do a variety of different shows Monday through Friday that are designed to either have special guests or topics. It's driven by topics or special guests. And then our Sunday night show is our News of the Week show, where we review the news of the week as we've carried it on our two websites at lacp.org and nasca.org, NAASCA.org. We do the news of the day every day, and we compile the news of the week, so the Sunday night show is a discussion of those articles. Again, thank you to Dr. Anna Baranowski and to her cohort and co-author, Teresa Lauer, for being our special guest tonight. This is Bill Murray saying thank you for listening. May God bless you, God bless America, North America, and may God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Blog Talk Radio.